Okay, and welcome back. Hour number three. With us this hour and back is Herbert Dorsey, a walking library of fascinating data and material. Herbert Dorsey has read more books than I could probably count, and he has assimilated extraordinary amounts of knowledge from them. We're going to talk about some very eclectic and unusual things tonight, as we always do when Herb is with us. Are you there, Herbert?
Yes, I am.
Welcome back.
I guess we're going to start the conversation with a little bit of history.
Well, it's always a good place to start. We're supposed to learn from history, although, okay, of course, the controllers would rather we didn't, but that's not going to stop us. So, yes, let's go into it.
Well, I'm going to talk about Lockheed Aircraft. Lockheed Aircraft, just like Douglas Aircraft, as William Tompkins is telling us, had advanced developer programs. And their advanced development programs were located in Burbank, originally located in Burbank, California, on the eastern side of the Burbank-Glendale-Pasadena Airport.
Right.
During World War II, there was a plastic factory right next door that stunk like heck. So the name Skunk Works became the favorite name for this department of Lockheed Aircraft. Mark Rich joined Lockheed in 1950, and his designs gave the United States its first operational jet fighter plane.
Mark Rich was an aeronautical engineer, I guess we could call him that, right?
Yeah.
Now, 1950, I just want to set this, we're talking about history. This is just 5 years after the alleged end of World War II, 5 years after the Germans had dazzled the world with the Messerschmitt 262 twin jet fighter. In 1941-42, the Hitler foolishly tried to turn into a bomber, not recognizing the concept of air superiority fighters. They could have swept the skies clean had they put this fighter in its proper livery, but they did not until it was too late. So the U.S. and others began to develop turbofan turbojet engines, which is what we're talking about now with Herb Dorsey, in 1950 at the Skunk Works in Lockheed. Carry on, Herbert. Very good.
Okay, well, they liked him so much in December of 1954, Ben Rich was transferred to the Skunk Works, which is their advanced development company, where he worked on the SR-71, the stealth aircraft, and other advanced highly classified projects like the X-22A flying saucer. Now, of course, you probably never heard of it.
I have, but nobody else has, so please go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, Mark Rich was pretty secretive about what they were working on, as everybody was supposed to be there. But when he got a little bit older, up in age, he attended an alumni engineering meeting at UCLA in March of 1993. And at this meeting of engineering alumni, Ben Rich was showing slides, a slideshow, basically, and one of the slides had a black disk heading for outer space. And Ben Rich then said, "We now have the technology to take E.T. home. No, this won't take someone's lifetime to do it. There's an error in the equations. We now know what it is. We now have the capability to travel to the stars. First, you have to understand that we will not get to the stars using chemical propulsion. Second, we have to find out where Einstein went wrong." After making this amazing statement, one of the students raised his hand and asked, "Well, how does this UFO propulsion work?" Ben Rich responded by asking, "How does ESP work?" The student responded, "All points in time and space are connected." Rich replied, "That's how it works." At a different time after that, Ben Rich stated, "We already have the means to travel to the stars, but these technologies are locked up in black projects, and it will take an act of God to ever get them out to benefit humanity. Anything you can imagine, we already know how to do." Well, that was a pretty amazing statement. And finally, on his deathbed in 1995 in Oxnard, California, Rich stated that the military can travel to the stars, and that extraterrestrial visitors on the Earth are real.
Yeah, so Herbert, excuse me. I want you people out there to listen very carefully. Ben Rich was acknowledged by many to be as brilliant an aeronautical engineer as we had in those days. Maybe we've ever had. That doesn't count the Germans who came in here on paperclip. That's a separate issue. But Ben Rich was a genius in his field. For him to say these kinds of things should give all open-minded people a moment to pause and think very carefully about the words uttered and what that may mean for all of us in terms of where we can go, where we have already been, and who else has already been here. This man is not going to disparage or demean his life's work on his deathbed or late in his career when he had cancer by saying things that weren't true. It just isn't going to happen. Go ahead.
Yes, those all those things were direct quotations that I quoted.
Please do the one on his deathbed again, the last one.
It just stated that the military can travel to the stars and that extraterrestrial visitors to the Earth are real.
Wow. Wow. You got to think about that, ladies and gentlemen. We can travel to the stars. Even if we could travel to Mars, which apparently happened a long time ago, Ben Rich is talking about the equation had a flaw. We fixed the flaw in the equation. We figured out how to do it, and we did it. That's amazing.
Oh, well, you know, William Tompkins stated in his book that we can start off here. We have the technology to start here, where planet Earth is located, and be at the center of our galaxy in 45 minutes. So I give you some idea.
Yeah.
Our galaxy is 100,000 light years across.
That's right. Now, for those who say E.T. can't come here because it's too far, it would take too long, you have to understand that this is a physics that is not being taught in the classroom anywhere. This is black ops, top secret, ultra top secret, above top secret physics technology that very few people know about. And we're very fortunate to be able to hear about it on this program through Bill Tompkins, who will be here next Wednesday night for 2 hours at least. And we're getting more from Herbert Dorsey tonight. Go ahead, Herbert. Sorry about the interruption, but this is not something just to be tossed out there. This is earth-shaking, paradigm-ripping material.
Okay, now you talk about William Tompkins. One of the things he mentioned in his book, Selected by Extraterrestrials, is there was in Germany and in Europe, but around, mainly centered around Germany and Austria, there was 1,442 people out there that were all working on trying to build a spaceship. And this is, we're talking back in the early 20th century.
Right.
We're not talking 21st century. We're talking early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to wonder, well, gee, you know, they never taught us in school. Now, I got a degree in electrical engineering, a lot of physics background. They never taught us how any of this would be possible.
Mm-hmm.
So how could these people possibly be able to build a spaceship and get into outer space? Well, my own researches show that in that area of the world, in that time of history, there was another science that was being developed. And just to give you a few glimpses of this other science, there was a very famous chemist by the name of Wilhelm Reichenbach. And he invented a lot of new chemical procedures, and he built a lot of factories and all along the Rhine River. And he also experimented in things that we don't even think about. Like, he was interested in why people are sleepwalkers. They had a lot of people who were sleepwalkers. And he started to investigate it, and he found out that the incidence of sleepwalking increased dramatically during the full moon. And so he started to get the... He actually had patients, and they would come to him, and he would shield them in a room that was shielded from moonlight, and they would stop sleepwalking. So he was really interested in this phenomena. So he got a big plate of metal, and he had
it. Oh, we may have lost Herb there. You there, Herbert? All right, we're going to have to get him back. Yeah, we dropped. We'll get him right back. Wilhelm Reich and Bach. Wilhelm Reich, another man, very famous. Wilhelm Reichenbach, not quite so famous in our time. A lot of people have heard about orgone and have studied the work of Wilhelm Reich. Fascinating material, to be sure. Look under Herbert's name, and you'll see some things to look at. I put up the video, Astonishing World War II German Flying Disc Technology. Look at that. It may have the only piece of black and white film of a flying German disc. We can't absolutely verify it, but I've had my editor take a look at it and enhance it, enlarge it. Well worth looking at, and dozens of still photos of what is clearly an advanced flying disc program in Germany in the late 30s and 40s. They had multiple different models. All right, we got Herbert back. Go ahead, Herbert, please.
Sorry, we got cut off there.
That's right.
In the middle of I was talking about Wilhelm Reichenbach and his unusual experiments. And well, he found out that if he shone the light of the moon on this plate, and he had a bundle of wires electrically connected to the plate, and he could take a sensitive in another room and bring these wires up just close to the sensitive, and they would start feeling very nauseous, and they'd have convulsions and things like that. And less sensitive people, they'd actually have to touch the wire before they felt the same effects. So he knew that there was some kind of energy being transmitted in this moonlight. He then tried the same experiment with sunlight, and he found out that these sensitive people were suddenly feel very invigorated when they touched the wire that was connected to the plate. And so he thought, well, gee, there's some kind of energy. And he had a galvanometer by the wire when the experiments were going, and he also had an electrometer. And the electrometer leaves weren't deflected, and the galvanometer showed no electric current. So he decided it wasn't an electrical phenomenon.
Huh.
And then he carried the experiment further. He had a darkened basement. He put a pan with dirt in it and planted seeds in the dirt in this darkened basement. And then he put a plate suspended over the seeds. And then he had a wire going outside to another plate that was in the sunlight. And that way he was able to grow plants in complete darkness just by the energy transmitted by the sunlight through a wire. And he was very curious about this force. He did another experiment, and he found out it traveled along the wire about the same speed as a man walking. So it wasn't electricity for sure. But anyway, he called this force Ode. It was a life-giving force, and he gave it the name the Ode force. And later on, we had another German scientist who decided to come to America when Hitler was coming to power. His name was Wilhelm Reich. And Wilhelm Reich discovered a similar type of life-giving force. He called it orgone energy. And he was able to cure cancer with this orgone energy. And he was able to change the weather. He was actually able to, he invented a device called a cloud buster. And he could either make the clouds go away, or he could make them increase depending on how he handled it. And this technology was taken up by another fellow named James Trevor Constable. He has his own weather engineering website.
Yeah, it's actually Trevor James Constable. He's been friend of mine for a long time.
Here.
Yeah, that's okay. Trevor's a wonderful man.
With
oh, yeah. He's been on the program a lot. Yeah.
Reich himself was able to actually create living matter from sterilized sand, silica sand, using this orgone energy. And so he was an amazing scientist that discovered a lot of interesting things. And for his trouble in this country, he was imprisoned, and by court order, all his books were burned. You know, it's supposed to be a free country, but sometimes you wonder. But anyway, he was, you know, about a few days before he was due to be released from prison, he mysteriously died in prison. So
yeah, the government didn't want him on the loose. It's sad.
So apparently he couldn't escape the forces of fascism.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, to carry on, Then we had Victor Schauberger in Austria, and he discovered a way to use the vortex of water or air, and he could actually created free energy machines using this vortex technology. He also figured out ways to make the water a lot healthier, and he also discovered levitation, and he discovered this by watching the trout swim straight up a waterfall. And that seemed like it'd be impossible
for
a trout to swim straight up, but he was seeing them do it. And he invented something called the trout turbine, and later on it was called the repulsine. And these devices actually were not only created free energy, but they also created levitation. And this is totally an unknown science known in the United States. So the main person, though, the really exceptional person was a fellow by the name of Carl Schappeler. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Dr. Carl Schappeler.
How do you spell it?
S-C-H-A-P-P-E-L-L-E-R.
Schappeler.
I suppose that's a French pronunciation.
That would be the French pronunciation. Schappeler or Schappeler.
Okay, Schappeler. Carl, K-A-R-L is
yeah.
his first name.
Yeah.
And he developed a science known as the physics of the primary state of matter. And in this, in his theory, of course, he had the all-pervading ether concept that all the physicists in those days knew was out there.
Yeah.
And a lot of these free energy inventions like Schauberger's and others depend on this the existence of this ether.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he posited that the ether is not only all-pervading throughout the universe, and the reason why magnetic, gravitational, and electric fields can cause action at a distance. He also said that this ether is conscious. It actually has consciousness. He said this is the property of God that created all it is and is everywhere present. That this is what ether is. It's consciousness as well as these other things that we've talked about. And this is a big radical departure from conventional physics. But anyway, he developed a theory, and he actually made working devices from this primary, he calls it the primary state of matter, because he said that the regular physics that we're taught in school is what he calls secondary physics. The secondary physics are the effects that are caused by the primary physics. So what we're dealing with is a physics of effects without finding out what the causes are.
Now, that's very interesting. Very interesting. Okay, I follow that. That makes sense.
And one of the big things, one of the features of this is that ether itself is this, all matter is created from ether. And so all matter itself is conscious. Everything from the smallest atom to the most complex biological organism. And when you really think about it, and I thought about this when I was in college, I asked myself, what is the dividing line between conscious matter and unconscious matter? I thought about it in depth, and I realized that, well, it's already proven that plants are very conscious. Peter Tompkins in The Secret Life of Plants did plenty of experiments.
Cleve Baxter, the other one who did it?
Well, there was several different people that did it.
Yeah.
But actually, it's been proven by experiments that plants are very conscious of our emotions, and they react to different emotions that we have when we're around them. They did tests with galvanic skin response electrodes,
yeah.
Galvanic skin response meter, and they tried experiments with different types of thoughts and emotions directed towards the plants. And they got some really dramatic results.
If you go into a room, Herbert, to underscore what you're saying, with the intent of cutting leaves off one of the plants, that plant will know it when you walk in the room. It'll sense
yeah.
your intent.
That's right. And this has also been proved at Findhorn, where they give lots of love to their plants and they just grow so profusely. And
right.
Some people have the green thumb and other people have the brown thumb. And it probably has a lot to do with their emotional feelings towards the plant. But anyway, plants are conscious. Well, what about minerals? Well, there's been a lot of healers around that will tell you that crystals can be programmed and they can be cleared. And so maybe crystals might be conscious also. Well, I was wondering about this because I was reading this paper about the T4 virus.
Uh-huh.
When you dehydrate it, it forms into crystalline forms. And so maybe there's a connection between a virus and a crystal, that maybe there's some consciousness in both of those. If you take like a single-celled amoeba...
We're going to go through the break, Todd. Thank you. Go ahead, Herbert. Continue.
A single-celled amoeba has no eyes or ears or sense of touch or taste. It doesn't have a brain to process data, but it's still conscious of its surroundings because it knows which way to go to find its food and assimilate it.
Uh-huh.
So we see that we don't need all this stuff to have a level of consciousness. Well, then I got to thinking about electrons. In the atom, there's the thing known as the Pauli exclusion principle, that no two electrons can be in the same energy state within an atom. And I got to thinking, well, how does each electron know what all the other electrons are doing? Isn't that a form of awareness of its surroundings, which is consciousness? So I finally came to the conclusion that all matter is truly conscious. Of course, there's different degrees and levels of this consciousness, but this is basically the primary state of matter is a conscious thing. And Chappeller goes into a lot of theory. I sent you a link to a book that gets into it. It's called The Physics of the Primary State of Matter.
Mm-hmm.
He also built some devices to back up his theories with actual experiments. And as some people call it the Chappeller device. And he had this substance he called glowing magnetism. Well, glowing magnetism in his theory about the formation of stars is that's what these stars really are. They're glowing magnetism, according to his theory. And it's explained in that book that I sent you a link for.
Mm.
He built a device that created glowing magnetism in the core. It was a spherical-shaped device. RexResearch.com has... his device has the plans for it and the theory of how it works and everything.
Oh, it's there's no IER, it's just ELER. Carl Chappeller.
Okay,
Carl Chappeller. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, this guy wasn't just coming up with a wild theory. He had working devices based on his theory. And this book that I mentioned, It does have pictures of the device inside of it, as well as Rex Research website. They have pictures of it. So anyway, this is a big departure. A lot of physicists nowadays are trying to come up with a theory of everything that would explain consciousness along with all the other forces that we do know about. And so far, they really haven't been able to do it. But Chappeller developed his theory at the early part of the 20th century and actually had a device based on it that he built. So yeah, I thought that would be interesting to bring up. The other thing is that Professor Schumann, he's the fellow that was working at the Technical Institute at Munich. And also in Munich was Maria Orsic, was living in Munich. And, you know, Maria Orsic was the one who had the telepathic communication with the light beings from Aldebaran.
Aldebaran, yeah.
Aldebaran, okay.
Now, Maria Orsic, if you look under Herbert's name and look at the link to the advanced German disc technology. You'll see pictures of Maria Orsic toward the end of the picture scroll there. She's a very beautiful woman. These pictures from the 1930s, apparently, late 30s. And it was described by those who knew her that she was didn't age much and a very extraordinary person. So you can see her there if you want to take a look. Go ahead.
Yes, and she was very psychic. And she had a band of friends who were also psychic. And she finally started up this society that's known as the Brill Society in Germany.
Right.
And it was basically all psychic ladies in the Brill Society.
And I didn't know they were all women, or mostly all women. That's interesting.
Well, but later on they let some men in, but the original formation was all women who were psychic mediums. Okay. And Maria and some of her other mediums were in contact with these light beings from Aldebaran. And they gave her the instructions on how to build what they called an otherworld flying machine.
Right.
Jenseitsflugmaschine in German.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, she looked at the diagram. She drew the diagrams because they put pictures in her head, so she just drew them out. And she also did automatic writing when she was in trance. But the problem is the writing was in the ancient Templar language and an even more ancient Sumerian language.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to take these scripts that she wrote in automatic writing, and they had to go to experts in ancient languages, and they had them translated. Well, finally she got the translations and the pictures all there in German so she could understand it. And she didn't understand it because it was too technical for her. She asked her father. Her father was, his name was Tomislav Orsic, mm-hmm. and he happened to be work at this this technical institute in Munich. And he said, well, I don't understand it either, but I'll take it to Dr. Schumann and see what he has to say about it. Well, Dr. Schumann looks over all the stuff, and he was very familiar with Schapeller's theory, mm-hmm. and also Victor Schauberger's theories. He was well-versed in both of them. And apparently the theory of how this otherworld flying machine was supposed to work had some similarities to both the other men's theories. So he said, well, this looks interesting. Let's try and build one and see what we come up with. And so they got financing from the Thule Society. They weren't wealthy enough to do it on their own, but with the Thule Society members, who are a lot of them were very affluent, they were able to build this otherworld flying machine.
So they built a spaceship.
It wasn't really a spaceship at the time. It was, let's put it this way, it was a prototype model.
Okay.
And the first one they built was an utter failure, by the way.
They turned it into a restaurant, I'll bet, or something. All right, just kidding.
What happened, the pilot got in it and started to lift off. He got about 50 feet in the air, and the whole thing started to wobble like crazy. Because you see, there was two kind of rotating discs inside of it. And apparently they had some mechanical problems. And it started
Got off the ground. Interesting.
It lifted about 50 feet in the air. It started wobbling like crazy, and the pilot tried to bring it down, and he jumped out of it. He was scared. And the whole thing kind of just shook itself apart and disintegrated. And so they were ready to throw in the towel at that point. And Maria and her friends went back to their channeling, and a couple of days later they came out back to Schumann with some plans on how to rectify the problems.
Uh-huh.
They finally built the second model. And this time, before they launched the second model, they had two psychic mediums right there with a pilot, and they were channeling information, and they were giving all kind of advice to the pilot and everything.
Same guy, do you think? Do we know?
Huh?
Was it the same pilot?
I don't know.
That would be a funny story. All right.
Yeah.
May I ask a question? Hold your thought. We're right there. They've got their second ship built. We'll come right back. The book that you mentioned, the primary state of physics?
The physics of the primary state of matter.
How does that figure into where we are right now again? What's the connection?
Well, some of the principles that were developed by Scheppeler were also similar to the principles of this other world flying machine.
Okay. All right. Okay. Very good. All right. Good. Thank you.
And that's why Schumann agreed to even build it, because he was already familiar with the other theories. And so he looked at these plans and the translated words that went with the plans, and he decided, well, it'd be interesting, let's give it a try.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So by 1924, they actually had a working machine, but this had other problems. Now this machine, it seemed to have other extra-dimensional features about it, because they flew it for about 55 minutes. And then they brought it back down, and the machine looked, it was started out brand new, and after 55 minutes it came back, it looked like it was over 100 years old.
What year would this have been about, Herbert?
1924.
All right.
Yeah. It's all in my book, Secret Science and the Secret Space Program.
Okay.
And so, Maria explained to him, well, these are the effects of interdimensional travel. And all the engineers were horrified. And Schumann he wasn't so horrified, because he had Maria Warsick that could go into her trance and be able to come up with working solutions to the problems.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they kept improving the models. And it led to the series of... This original series is called the JFM, for Jensen Height Flug Machine. It was called the JFM series, and then these later evolved into the Vril craft. And Dr. Schumann is known as the father of the levitation devices in Germany. So later on, after the war, he was brought in an Operation Paperclip into the United States. And his main claim to fame, now that we know about most all the stuff about flying saucers and things like that, were all hushed up and kept secret. But Schumann now has his claim to fame as the Schumann resonance that we all hear about,
sure.
You know, the Earth's resonant frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So that's his big claim to fame now.
7.86 hertz, but it changed.
Right, right. So I just wanted to bring up this idea of the primary state of matter, and the idea that matter is conscious, because I think people need to understand that and maybe have a little more respect for the ecology of the planet. The planet itself is a conscious entity itself. When you look at a beautiful sunset at nighttime, think about the Mother Earth that provides us with our home and our life, and how valuable that is.
Yeah.
And be, you know.
What a gift.
To give respect for this.
Supposed to.
And treat the Earth with respect.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, mentioning Maria Orsic is very interesting. What happened to her and the Vril Society, V-R-I-L, later on?
They were going, they were active right up to the end of...
World War
II. The end of German defeat.
Mm-hmm.
After the Russians occupied Berlin and everything, they disappeared. All the members disappeared.
She did leave a cryptic remark saying that we're out of here. We're going elsewhere, and it was suggested by those who knew about them that they did go through a wormhole or a whatever hole and went to Aldebaran. So.
Yes, there's one account in that book that I mentioned, The Secret Science and Secret Space Program, where she had already been informed by the beings of light from Aldebaran that Germany was going to lose the war. And she had Dr. Schumann hire some engineers, and they made her two more craft that were about 27 feet in diameter or so. Some, they were small ones. And she was going to use those to join. She was going to go to Aldebaran. And she wasn't the only one, by the way. They had meetings. Hitler had Maria Orsic and some other people in the Tool Society. They actually made plans to go to Aldebaran themselves. And they actually had I think it was a Hanabu Dostra. And it was called the Odin, was the name of it. And they were going to take a trip to Aldebaran via what they call an extra-dimensional channel.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, it would take, about 65 light years to get there. At the speed of light, it would take 65 years. So anyway,
look under Herbert Dorsey's name and guess on the left-hand side and take that first link right there. It talks about German disc technology, astonishing World War II German flying disc technology, and you can scroll down. There's a video at the top of it. Scroll down, and you will see a number, dozens of pictures of German UFO-type discs, craft, flying. And these are old black and whites. They're not new. They're not Photoshop CGI stuff. It just takes one to be real. But you'll see pictures of Maria Orsic and another woman that she was apparently with. Then you'll see a computer representation of how they went from point A to point B over such a long distance in a very short period of time. And then you'll find some text at the bottom of it with some drawings of the various Hanabu craft and the Vril 7 craft. You see, they're all drawn down there for you. But it's a very valuable... I don't know if you've seen that link or not, Herbert, but it's under your name, so after the program, by all means, take a look through.
Okay. You see, this is old history. This happened before and during World War II. But you see, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
So where is all this technology gone now?
Wow.
Well, one good source of information is Corey Good. Corey Good worked on the Solar Warden program for 20 years. He did a 20 and back, he signed up for a 20 and back tour of duty, so he knew what he was getting into before he left. And basically, the 20 and back tour of duty, you served 20 years out in space off the planet. You're denied any contact with planet Earth during that time. After your 20 years of duty is over with, you're returned to the Lunar Operations Command, which is our big base on the moon, mm-hmm. big secret when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
And they take these men, and the first thing they do is erase their memory, selectively erase it, of the 20 years that they were in on their tour of duty. The next thing they do is they give us quite a few drugs, and they put them almost in a state of suspended animation for about 2 weeks. I mean, they're just barely conscious during this time, and they have to be kept totally still, according to the people who have been through it. And they actually get age regressed 20 years. So now they look like the same age as when they first started.
20 and back. It's called 20 and back.
Right. And then they send them through a time technology that they also have back 20 years to just before they signed up. So suddenly they're back on, and then they ship them back to planet Earth. So here they are on planet Earth with no memory of what they've just been through, and they seem like they're the same age they were a day before. But they're kind of confused for a while, and it takes a while to get back into it. So, theoretically, you could have a normal life and not even be aware of your 20 years of service. And that way they could keep everything nice and secret. You wouldn't be spilling secrets to your friends and family about what you'd been through. And for most people, it seemed to work. But there's been three that I know of, that it didn't work. Michael Relf was the first one. He was on the Mars Defense Force.
Right. When you say it didn't work, it didn't work. What happened? They're 20 years older.
Well,
they remember everything.
They gradually started remembering incidents and stuff. It started coming back to them. And you know, it took a while, but they started having memories. Michael Ralph, he married a lady who was a neurolinguistic practitioner, and she knew that her husband was suffering from severe post-traumatic stress syndrome,
right.
And she was trying to cure him. And during these treatments of him, these memories would start coming out. And so his wife helped him to remember all the stuff that went on when he was in the Mars Defense Force. And he was had some pretty heavy stuff happen to him. And he was, later on, after he recovered most of his memories, his wife wrote a book called The Mars Chronicles. So if you check on Amazon.com, you can probably find The Mars Chronicles.
When was this book written, approximately?
Oh, I'm not sure the date, but I know it's been around for, I'd say about 7-8 years, maybe longer.
Right.
And he was probably the first one to come forward with the story of Mars, besides Andrew Visaggio. Andrew Visaggio probably came out before he did. Now, Andrew Visaggio is interesting because he claims he went to Mars on in a jump room, which is like a teleportation technology. This jump room was situated next to L.A. International Airport on Sepulveda Boulevard, Boulevard near El Segundo. And he would go into this thing, and they would push some buttons, and it looked like an elevator. This door would go in, slide open, they'd go in and push some buttons, and the whole thing seemed like a big gut-wrenching, twisting sensation, and the whole room started to look like it was a cylinder instead of a square, and then it would be over with, and the gut-wrenching would go away, and it would return back to a square shape, and they'd push another button, and the opposite door would open up, and they'd go out, and they'd be on Mars. And Andrew Visaggio said that he was really impressed that you could actually breathe the air on Mars. It was pretty thin, and it was fairly cold, but he could actually breathe it. He didn't need to have a spacesuit on to be out there. But they usually used some oxygen supplementals when they went on expeditions around there. Because
it doesn't surprise me. I'm not that. I believe that. Yeah.
So, and he's not the only one that said that. A number of other people have too, including Michael Ralph and another guy named Randy Kramer. He also was on the Mars Defense Force, and he had been through some pretty bloody battles, really violent battles.
Who were they fighting? Do you know, Herbert?
Yes, they have other beings. They actually have reptilians that live on Mars. They're not the Draco reptilians. They're a different Mars based reptilians. And they have also the praying mantis type of ET, which looks like a big grasshopper, sort of.
Yeah.
They got both of those types on Mars, and both of those will fight to defend their territories. And they also have some human types, not from Earth, but some Martian human types, too, according to some of the reports I've heard. But anyway, the Mars Colony Corporation created a number of colonies on Mars, and they actually contract out the Mars Defense Force to defend their colonies. So actually the CEOs have they have the final say, and they can give orders to the commanders of the Mars Defense Force, which is really a disastrous way to do things, because as Randy Kramer said and it's a story which I do have in the Secret Space Program, Secret Science, Secret Space
You can
program.
Find that under Herbert's name as well, the name of this book he keeps mentioning. It's right there, and just click and you go to the Amazon page if you want to buy it.
Randy Kramer, two things happened to him. They have women fighters as well as men fighters there, by the way. He said about 20% of their fighters are women. And he fell in love with one of the women and got married to her. And they'd fight side by side in these different battles they were having. And then one day she got killed in battle. It was very upsetting for him.
I would think.
And he really did love her quite a bit. And another thing that happened right towards the end of his 17 years, he was spending 17 years there. One of the CEOs of the Mars Corporation, they had just signed a treaty, a peace treaty with these reptilians that were living there. And almost immediately after the treaty was signed, the CEO decided, well, he wanted some really fancy artifacts that were in this reptilian temple. And so he ordered the Mars Defense Force to raid this temple. This is after they'd already signed a peace treaty. Because, you know, corporate greed knows no bounds and has no common sense. But anyway, the commander thought it was a terrible idea, and Randy Kramer thought it was a terrible idea. And they sent four divisions of men in there, about 970-some men, to go out to raid this reptilian temple. And of those 970-some men that went in, only 35 came out alive, because it was a really bloody battle. And Randy Kramer just happened to be one of the survivors. And he was blown up pretty bad. But they have really advanced medical technology. They can rebuild your organs really quickly.
Now, were all these 970-some men, were they Earth men?
Yeah, he was from Earth.
Okay, I know he was, but the others, they were all Earth men, not Earth-like
men.
Oh, yeah,
they were all brought in from the planet Earth. They have two types of people living on Mars. They got the colonists. Now, get this. The colonists were brought here during the 60s and 70s to Mars. They were usually pretty intellectual people and usually white Aryan people. There was kind of a racist thing going on who they would select. And they were told that the Earth was going to have a major disaster. It was going to wipe out all the life on planet Earth. And that they needed these people to go to Mars for the sake of the survival of the human race. And so they would recruit these different people and tell them that. And they had to keep it secret. They didn't want to get everyone upset. So they had to keep it secret. And before they left, they would have them write up this big bundle of postcards. And they would state that they were found a wonderful job in another country, and they would have updates from month to month and everything. They'd have all this written up before they even left. And then they'd take them up to Mars, and the agents running the program down here would release these postcards to their friends and relatives every couple of months or so at first, and then maybe once or every year. And then eventually they would taper off to nothing. And the people would think, oh, they're moved to another country, they're happy, so they wouldn't worry about them, right? So this is how they'd handle that. Well, then they got up on Mars, and they put them to work building the colonies. And, you know, there were so many people that were taken up there. In England, it caused what was called the English brain drain. That's what the English called it. Now, a lot of their scientists and people were disappearing from England. And they actually had this movie. It was fiction. It was actually fact presented as fiction. It was called Alternative 3. And anybody who's seen the movie knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I remember that.
Okay. So anyway, all these people started disappearing, and they were taking them up to Mars. And they first put them to work building all the installations where they'd live and everything, and in the factories. And then they started working in the factories making trade goods. And, you know, after they were there for a while, they told them, oh, a big disaster did happen on Earth and wiped out all the life on the planet Earth, and there's no way you can ever go back. So these people were like trapped on Mars. They had to stay there for the rest of their lives. And they were working the colonies thinking that, you know, oh, too bad, you know, Earth is gone. We can never go back to our home planet. Okay, so these were the colonists that lived there. Then they had these people on the Mars Defense Force that were coming up from Earth. They knew that no disaster had happened.
Right.
Okay, but they had a strict policy. None of the people defending the colonies could ever visit the colonies. All their outposts were located quite a bit separate.
They kept them separated, I see.
They kept them separated because they didn't want any anything to leak out that, yeah, the Earth is still thriving, you know. Mm-hmm. And they could go back if they wanted. So anyway, these people were like, basically, they were owned by the Mars Colony Corporation.
Got it.
They'd pay them a meager salary, you know, enough for their basic necessities, but then mm-hmm. they'd spend it all at the company store. And so, you know, it was almost like slavery. I mean, the
sounds
next thing,
like it.
Yeah.
Herbert,
okay,
we're out of time this visit. That you covered a lot of material. That was
okay.
Really amazing. Plan your next visit, and we can pick it up there, whatever you'd like to do. One quick question. It's quite clear from looking at the photographs coming back from Mars, the Curiosity rover and the others, and the ES, the European Space Agency, overflights and aerial views, that the planet's surface is covered with relics of a civilization that was destroyed. Pieces. There's chunks
right.
everywhere. What do you know about that? What happened, and when did it happen?
Well, Corey Good is a good source of information on that.
Can we get Corey? Can we get him on this program?
You'll have to contact him now. He's in contact with Michael Sala. Michael Sala has interviewed him.
Yeah, we're working on getting Michael next week. Yeah,
and also David Wilcox has done a whole series called Cosmic Disclosure,
mm-hmm.
a whole series of interviews with him.
All right.
So,
well,
those two men, you could contact them. And
we'll
see
about that. Yeah, very good. All right. Well, plan your next visit, and thank you very much, Herbert, as always. Remarkable material, and we will think about it carefully.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Thanks.
Stay in touch.
Okay, Herbert, I will. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, good night. Herbert Dorsey, and lots to think about there. Okay, that's a busy night again. We'll be back tomorrow night. Busy night then, too. So take care, and we'll talk soon.